Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Hey, y'all. Today we have a conversation between old friends Rick Rubin and Michael Stipe. Along with his former Georgia-based band R.E.M., Stipe helped popularize what was once called alternative music. With his open-hearted lyrics, Stipe gave voice to the sensitive and misunderstood among us, with hits like The One I Love, Everybody Hurts, and Losing My Religion. On today's episode, Michael plays Rick a new song of his called Future If Future, produced by Andy LeMaster. The song, as he explains, was released in partnership with Earth Percent, which gives artists a simple way to support groups fighting climate change, something Stipe cares deeply about. Michael Stipe also talks about the upcoming solo album he's recording and how he always intended to be super famous, and then what it was like when it actually happened. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Michael Stipe.
Hello, Rick. It has been a very long time since I've seen you, and you look great.
You too. How long have you lived in New York?
It depends on which government agency you talk to, but I've been here since 1987.
I see. Do you ever go back to Georgia?
I spent most of lockdown in Georgia with my mother, my sisters, and a few very close, my family. I had some vulnerable people in my family, so I spent most of lockdown there. And then starting last summer, summer of 21, was able to travel to our home in Berlin, because I now live between New York and Berlin. Mm-hmm. And then came back when things got bad again with Delta.
When you're in Georgia, is that at home in the house that you grew up in?
No, it's a misnomer that I grew up in Georgia. My father was in the army, so I traveled my whole life with him. He was in Vietnam twice. He was in Korea once during my lifetime. And we would pick up and move every couple of years. So I was born in Georgia. I returned to Georgia when I was 18 because my father retired. He and my mom moved to Athens because there's a college there that my uncle went to. He is this incredible activist, and spent the 60s and 70s in Athens as an activist at the University of Georgia. My mom and dad liked the sound of it, and so they moved there in 1978 when I was 18, and I followed them. I was living with a punk rock band in Granite City, Illinois, and I ran out of money, and I moved with my tail between my legs. I moved to Athens, Georgia, thinking that it was a hippie cow town and that I didn't fit in because I was this, you know, urban punk rocker. And it turns out that one of the most incredible punk rock scenes in America was happening right under my nose in Athens, Georgia, and I became a part of it.
Unbelievable. What are the odds of that being the case? It's just a remarkable, you would never guess it.
Also that it would be, you know, the band that kicked it off, of course, are the B-52s. And that's a band, in my opinion, that have not yet gotten their due recognition for the degree to which they altered the trajectory of contemporary music.
Who were the other bands in the Athens scene at that time? Like post B-52s, pre-REM, what was that window?
Pre-REM would include the Method Actors and Pylon, and that's about it. With REM came a band called The Side Effects and then a couple of other bands. There was a whole scene going on in Atlanta, but there's always been this weird thing like San Bernardino, LA County kind of thing between Atlanta and Athens. There was a band called Vietnam there. There was a RuPaul's early band, RuPaul and Wee Wee Pole, a band called The Now Explosion. And that was, they were all really fun people and we would hang out with them from time to time. But it was really Athens had its own thing going on. A lot of that had to do with Jeremy Ayers, my mentor, the first, really the first love of my life in a way. And he had moved from Athens where he grew up to New York. Became involved in Andy Warhol's factory as a drag queen named Silva Thin, who Andy loved, but Paul Morrissey, who made all the movies, didn't like very much. Anyway, Andy really hung on to Silva until Jeremy decided to move back to Athens. And then he was really profoundly involved in the beginnings of the B-52s and helped kind of set the stage for what Athens would become as this like hotbed of new music.
What was your first memory of the punk rock world in the United States? So we're not including Sex Pistols. We're not including like your first U.S. experience of punk rock. What was it?
Oh, it predates the Sex Pistols. It's
really?
I was in detention in high school in 1975. And under my desk where I sat, someone had left a torn up copy of Cream magazine. And there was an article written by Lisa Robinson about CBGB. And she was comparing the CBGB scene to, as a black and white scratchy TV, to the Technicolor bloviating, bloated, rich, we're better than everyone else kind of rock scene that was happening in modern America, and saying this is so much more real and so much more raw and so much cooler, and these are the people involved in it. And there was a photograph of Patti Smith, and she looked for all the world like you know, like a vampire. Yeah. Black and white picture, she's got her eyes wide open, and I saw the picture and I was like, these are my people. And I read the article and I was like, this is it. So I wound up accidentally subscribing to the Village Voice. My sister had one of those Columbia House subscriptions where you paid a dime and you could get 10 magazines for free. Mm-hmm. And the Village Voice just sounded like fun. So she asked me to pick a few magazines and I picked that one. And suddenly I was immersed into the whole CBGB scene. And I started following it and I bought Patti's first album the day that it came out when I was 15 years old. And I decided then and there that I was going to become a singer in a band. And that was going to be my life. And I naively moved forward with that. And I outrageously and very luckily succeeded at it.
It's unbelievable. It's a beautiful story. And what was your experience of music prior to the punk rock experience? Did you love music from young childhood or no?
I loved music, but I was only exposed really to pop radio. And the 5 years that are kind of probably most significant to me are the years that we spent in Texas. We had moved from Frankfurt, outside of Frankfurt, Germany, where there was pop radio, but it was all German. So it was like the Beatles singing Michel Maybel in German. I distinctly remember that as a child, standing in a cabbage garden, if you can believe it. It was very German. Wow. In 1967. And moving as a 7 or 8 year old to Texas, and then hearing pop radio, which included Tammy Wynette and a lot of country music, but then also the Archies and the Banana Splits and whatever, you know, the Flintstones were primetime TV at that point during the Vietnam War. Yeah, my exposure to pop radio during those years between 67 and 73, that was really primo, amazing radio. In terms of music that I really clocked as a young teen, I always cite Rock On by David Essex,
yeah,
which I then kind of extrapolated into the song Drive by REM. It's a very, very, that whole album, in fact, is really referencing the 1970s and the song by song. You can go to Everybody Hurts is Nazareth. The band Nazareth covers Love Hurts, which was an earlier song from, I think, the 1950s or 60s. Drive was my homage to David Essex and Rock On. The other song that I always name is my now very, very, very dear friend and a man who I love very much, but Elton John put up Biddy and the Jets. And I had never heard anything like that before. It was absolutely mind-blowing to me that the production, it was really, and I'm talking to you about this, but it was really the production.
Yeah.
The song is a great song. And he's, of course, an amazing artist. But the production of that song was so whacked out. And the production of Rock On by David Essex was so whacked out. But I think that was coming out of, you know, what was happening with the glam rock in England, the early kind of Mark Bolan, very early David Bowie, Slade. The Bay City Rollers might have come a little bit later, and they were very pop, of course. But I think a lot of that production stuff was coming from there.
So after you saw the picture of Patty, did you go to find her? Is that the next step? You went to New York? That was what drew you?
I did not go to New York for another 3 years. I didn't actually meet Patty until 20 years later.
Wow.
1995 that we actually met each other.
Incredible. Incredible.
We can continue from 1979 when I first came to New York. But you and I go back a long, long way. And we all have our pasts that are maybe a little bit embarrassing. But I know that you used to spend a good bit of time in New York at Exterminator Chili.
Yes.
Remember that place?
Loved it.
My two best friends worked there, Tom Gilroy and Jim McKay, both artists. And Michael Imperioli, who went on to do The Sopranos, worked there as well. But you used to go for lunch and occasionally for dinner.
Yes. And the person who managed Exterminator Chili, whose name I can't think of now because I haven't thought about it since then, managed a band. And we ended up signing that band called Masters of Reality that were a super cool kind of psychedelic rock band.
I remember Masters of Reality. That's pretty cool. And also, but Wire ate there.
Wow.
The Chili Peppers made a video there, I think. And that might've been before your time.
Yeah. Thinking about the early days of punk rock and starting your post-punk band, I guess, would you qualify REM as post-punk?
I think so, yeah, yeah.
It was alternative music. Could you possibly imagine that it would become as popular and as mainstream as it ended up being?
I think, to be completely honest, I think that was my intention all along. I wanted to be as big as I could possibly be. I just wanted to be really super fucking famous. And not by any means necessary,
no.
Which is what you find in today's culture. You know, there are people that are famous for the sake of being famous, and you know, then they become a billionaire with a makeup line or whatever. That's a little insulting, frankly, for those of us who actually work at more than just business. But yeah, I knew that I had something to offer. I didn't know what it was when I was 19 or when I was 15, but you know, over the course of a few records, I figured out that I had a voice. And then much later, I found out that that voice was quite unique. And I started really enjoying the process of writing. And, you know, Peter, Mike, and I, and Bill, when he was in the band, were the best of friends. And we supported each other. We loved each other. We kept each other alive many times. And we had a great grand adventure together, which, you know, for me lasted 32 years.
Yeah.
The postpartum after 32 years is, let me tell you, that's something. That's a high that you don't come down from easily. And so it took me several years to kind of, I really had to step away from music because I'm all in, you know, I don't do anything halfway. I accept the defeats and the embarrassments along with the triumphs and the hit singles, but I don't do anything halfway. And so when REM finally disbanded, I needed to take a break and I needed to not think about or look at music for a long time. And it turned out it was like 5 years before I actually kind of accidentally fell back into it through Fisher Spooner. And then working with Andy on that project, I realized that he and I had this really good rapport as co-writers and we started working together. And now we're involving all these other people. Galen Leah, do you know her? She's this astonishing singer-songwriter from the Minneapolis, St. Paul area. She has this astonishing, incredible, incredible presence and a very, very unique voice. And our voices meld together beautifully. So Galen is contributing on the record. Some other people have stepped in to do work, and I'm just really very excited about it. It's a very different. You know, I have no representation now. I have no record company. I was under contract since I was 22 years old, and now I'm 62 years old, and I'm a free agent. I can do whatever I want, and I don't. There's nothing forcing me or making me make the choices that I make other than just wanting to create things that are beautiful and that inspire people in some way.
The reason I asked about what you thought was possible was I remember being in my parents' house and looking at the New York Times Sunday calendar section, and there was a full page ad for the Police at Madison Square Garden. And I remember looking at it and I think this is a mistake. The Police can't play at Madison Square Garden. They play at the clubs. I went to the Roxy and to the Ritz and to, you know, to the Palladium. They could maybe play at the Palladium. They can't play at Madison Square Garden. That's not where the Police play. That's not where the groups that I like play.
That must have been after Roxanne. Yeah, you know, my band, my former band, REM, opened for the Police, actually, not at Madison Square Garden, but at Shea Stadium.
Wow.
When they played there. And we had the same booking agent who Mike and Bill, the drummer and bass player for REM, former drummer and bass player, knew Ian Copeland very well. They worked for him in Macon when he first started. And he put us on this bill. It was us and Joan Jett and the Blackhearts and the Police. And we played a 20-minute set in the pouring rain. I was 23, I think. And Andy Warhol was there. And Joan Jett came and said hello. And I was really, because I loved the Runaways. And I loved Joan Jett. Who else? Matt Dillon came. Matt Dillon was a big fan. And he came by and said hello. So that was an august afternoon for us.
What was it like walking out onto that stage? What was the feeling? I imagine, what size places were you playing at that time at 23?
Oh, just clubs. We were playing clubs to seven people, Rick. Nobody knew who REM was. Nobody cared. And that's fine, you know? I mean, it was like throwing raw meat to dogs. You know, they had no idea who we were. We were on and off before they could get angry and like throw bottles at us. And, you know, we did a really tight set. Everything was very, very like Ramon speed at that point with REM. So it actually, I kind of developed a singing style because the band refused to play slower than they did. Mike was really loved the Ramones and really loved a really fast bass part. So everything was really like rockabilly Ramones kind of fast. And I got tired of singing that fast and I thought it was boring. So I started slowing down my part. It's one thing I could do. They wouldn't slow down. So I slowed down my part and that actually became a singing style for me. By the time we recorded our first album and a song like Talk About the Passion, they were playing everything really fast and jangly. And I was just singing very, very slowly and holding my vowels. And that became well, something like a singing style, I guess.
I'm so happy to see, I have to say, I feel, I miss you and I love you. And it's so nice to talk to you. And I feel like there are a million things for us to talk about because everything you said is the beginning of another conversation. Like we could talk about the Village Voice alone forever. I was a pack rat when I was a kid. And I subscribed to the Village Voice. And at one point, there was an entire room of my family house that I grew up in, floor to ceiling, the entire room of just Village Voice newspapers because I saved every one. Oh. And I didn't save them in any way that I could refer back to them. But when my mom would say, oh, we have to throw away these newspapers, I said, you can't throw them away because I might have to refer back to something in those. There was no way for me to do that. But I wanted to know all of the information in all of these newspapers. It was our life's blood.
We have a lot in common, Rick. Pack rat would be a very friendly term for what we call me and my father. I'm a hoarder. And I happen to have really good taste and I've had a fascinating life thus far. So the things that I've hoarded are, for the most part, pretty interesting stacks and piles. And, you know, Warhol had his time capsules, which was just cardboard boxes. And he would jam everything that came to him would go into a cardboard box. And that became time capsules. It was my friend, Todd Eberle, who he's a photographer, very talented artist. And he worked for Vanity Fair forever, but he was called to the Warhol Museum. And he was handed the task of photographing time capsules that Warhol had left when he died that had never been opened before. And he found some unbelievable things. I still regard Warhol as the greatest artist of the 20th century. A close second being Brancusi. Mm. Brancusi managed to bring modernism and traditionalism together, not capital T, but small t traditionalism together in art and do so in a way that was not only elegant, but insanely timeless.
Yeah, and felt new. It's interesting when someone can make something traditional and modern and it lives in both worlds.
It still feels new. That's the thing. You see a Brancusi piece and you're like, what is this? This is the most elegant, the most, I'm using that word a lot, but it does describe,
fits
his work. Yeah.
I remember one of my fondest memories of things that we got to do together was we went to Manhattan Center for an event for Johnny Cash. And it was a tribute to Johnny Cash, but he sang at the tribute. And it was a beautiful, I remember we were sitting up in the left balcony and it was just a beautiful night. And I was just so glad that we got to do that together.
I think it's because of you that I managed to make it backstage before the show. And I met Johnny for the first time. I had met June several times before because of charity events that we were both attending. But I had never met Johnny. And as it turns out, of course, that was in the last year of his life. So thank you for allowing me to meet Johnny Cash, one of my great heroes.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Michael Stipe. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with more from Rick Rubin's conversation with Michael Stipe.
When you guys first toured, what was your first tour vehicle?
A Dodge van.
Dodge van.
Yep. Green.
How many years were you guys in a Dodge van?
We didn't have a bus until 1984, so we were 4 years in a van.
It's just, I think it's interesting for people to understand at the time that you guys became who you became, what work went into it, because I don't know that that really exists in the world anymore. It's a little bit of a lost people going out on the road and building up a following and someday right. getting to play at the Rose Bowl, let's say, where I remember when I heard that you were playing at the Rose Bowl and you were already REM, and I was surprised you were playing at the Rose Bowl, because like, that's the Rose Bowl. It's unbelievable.
Patti Smith did an interview with The Guardian. She was quoting someone, I don't know who said it, but in referencing work as an artist, it's 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. And in the 1980s, we certainly put in our fair share of perspiration. And in the process of building up that audience and a reputation as a band, we actually got our chops. You know, we grew up in public. I mean, we had no idea what we were doing. I didn't know that a bass guitar made the low notes until our second album. I didn't know that. I knew that it was the one with four strings. That's all I knew. I mean, I was that ignorant of music, and yet we managed to create these songs that were really quite stunning. And we were lucky to work with people like Mitch Easter and Don Dixon in the early days to help us kind of form what was a sound. You know, at the time in the early 80s, everybody wanted the vocal really loud and the drums really loud because it was post-disco. And even if you were, no matter who you were, if you turn the drums up, you're going to have a hit, or you're more likely to have a hit. And we were like, turn the drums down, turn the vocal down, turn it. We were the people that were saying, turn everything down. We want everything quieter. Thank God for remastering, because we're able to go back into those recordings now and bring it up to speed to what these things sound like with digital technology, with the advent of all of our devices, and the way that we hear things now is very, very different from 1982.
Was the road from the Dodge van up to the eventually stadiums, was it a consistent road, or were there like moments on the way where there were breakthroughs? Can you remember the first time something big happened?
Well, the first big thing was when I walked on stage for the first time ever. And I was like, this is it. This is where I loved it. And half the time, again, I was, you know, I trance when I perform. So half the time I was kind of not really there. Mm-hmm. I could be reminded of something and be like, oh yeah, that's when I stumbled over and I hit that note that I don't usually hit. Or that's when someone threw something and it hit me in the shoulder. But I would go into really a trance state when I performed. And that's very lucky for me. You know, it kept me from becoming a terribly self-conscious. I was as pretentious as anyone. And I embrace that pretension. I love pretension as you know, if you think of it as a way to rise out of yourself and to allow yourself to become something bigger than what you are, then wow, I'm really pretentious and look where it placed me. I'm okay with that. Yeah, I love to perform. What was the question, Rick? That was a good question.
We were talking about the first moment where like something big happened. So the first one you gave me was stepping on stage and realizing this is for you. And then in the band, when was the first moments like, oh, this is, things are changing?
I can answer that. And it echoes the rest of our conversation.
Yeah.
We were voted band of the year, jazz and pop, Paz and Jop.
Yeah. Village Voice.
Murmur, our first album, 1983, record of the year.
Wow.
By the Critics' Choice. And that was over Michael Jackson's Thriller. So the enormity of that to us, we were living in this rundown Fleabag hotel in Times Square. I would eat one knish a day. I knew where I could go to get it. I knew where I could go and bat my eyelashes and get someone to buy me a beer. And not have to, you know, not have to get laid in the prop. But I lived off of a knish. We were living on $5 a day and a bag of M&Ms that my uncle left when he traveled through New York. We had nothing. And our record was the Village Voice record of the year over Michael Jackson's Thriller. We were playing clubs to 12 and 15 people at a time, you know, but anyway, I mean, those were the days, you know, it was good fun. And we made the most of it. And I'm glad I had those experiences.
And what was the next like breakthrough moment? It's like, oh, this is bigger than that. What were the, just looking for like the stages of development.
Fall on Me was the video that MTV had to play. I was disgusted by most music videos. I thought they were cheesy and stupid. So I refused to lip sync and we refused to perform in them. And Fall on Me became kind of a minor hit. And so in America. And so the video I shot with a 16mm camera in a rock quarry outside of Bloomington, Indiana, with a guy that I had a giant crush on at the time. And I developed the film, turned it upside down, ran it backwards, ran the words to the song over this really shitty black and white footage of a rock quarry. And that became the weirdest music video of the year on MTV. And so that was a big moment because I was like, wow, I can manipulate this. I can make them do things that they don't want to do just because they have to do it because the song is that good. Then of course we had a hit song, top 10 song with The One I Love. And that was, the video was by Robert Longo, who's a pop
incredible
artist and a great friend. And then the next big moment after that was the Green World Tour. And then after that was Losing My Religion. And when Losing My Religion hit, you know, if I ever had, I'm not a person who has ambitions. If they're there, they're unconscious or they're subconscious. I don't know which to call it, but I did always want to be really famous and I didn't realize what really that entailed. And looking at it from the other side, it's nice to be anonymous again. I'm on the subway and nobody knows who I am. They don't look at me. If anyone under the age of 30 does not even look at me because they just register old. And I'm fine with that. It's totally amazing. But Losing My Religion was when I went from being someone that was recognized by people in my age group who loved a certain type of music to being universally, wildly, insanely famous and on the street. Like I couldn't go anywhere. And it was okay. It was kind of charming. In New York, people yell whatever they want to yell at you. They tell you if they like you. They tell you if they think you suck. And I kind of love that about New York. And I never liked LA because I never knew where I stood with people there. Everyone's your friend. There, it's very isolating and very kind of aggressively calm, and I can't stand it. But, and I'm sorry, Los Angeles, there are aspects to it that I love, and there are people there that I love, but can't do it. But losing my religion really changed it for me. And the one thing, if I ever had an ambition, it might be to have a song of the summer. And losing my religion became REM's song of the summer. And that was thrilling.
Yeah. What do you remember about writing? First of all, when you wrote it, did you know that song was special?
No. In fact, we released it as the first single thinking that it was going to set up the next song, which was something much more pop. I don't remember what it was. Yeah. And then eventually, I think Everybody Hurts, which was a big ballad, and that became a hit song around the world. And so that was also really good for us. But, and that's a beautiful video as well. Yeah, no, we didn't know it was going. I mean, it's such a weird song. We had no idea that it was going to resonate the way that it did.
What do you remember about writing it?
I changed one lyric. I remember that's me in the kitchen. That's me in the spotlight. No, that's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. That's me in the corner. That's me in the kitchen. So what I was pulling from was being the shy wallflower who hangs back at the party or at the dance and doesn't go up to the person that you're madly in love with and say, I've kind of got a crush on you. How do you feel about me? So there's this whole relationship that's happening only in the person's mind. And he doesn't know whether he's said too much or hasn't said enough. So he's like in the corner of the dance floor, watching everyone dance and watching the love of his life on the dance floor, dancing with everyone because that's the most exciting person. Or he's in the kitchen, you know, behind the refrigerator. And I changed kitchen to spotlight. And instantly, of course, the song became about me, which it never was, I don't think. I mean, I'm pretty self-aware. But the video with Tarsem is what really pushed it over the edge. And that was probably the queerest video of all time. And that was kind of nice.
Yeah. I'm harping on it because I heard it the other day in a shop that I was in. And me and my partner stopped and listened to it. And we both looked at each other. And I don't know if we actually teared up or if we just had the feeling of tearing up. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like the emotion came. I don't know if there were actual tears. It's amazing that the song to this day has this power to it. And I don't truly understand it. You know, I don't know that it's the words. I don't know. I don't know why it has so much emotional resonance, but it's one of these songs that when you hear it, you know, the world stops and you're put in the place of wherever this song is happening and you're in the void of the song. It's mystical.
That's very generous. Thank you very much. That means a lot to me coming from you. Thank you.
Just tell me about the experience of writing the word. Did the music exist first? How did it happen?
The music just existed first. I know that Peter was tired of playing guitar and didn't, R.E.M.'s former guitarist, after touring for 9-10 years in the 1980s. And he was buying wild, interesting instruments that he didn't know how to play. And his experimentation as a musician was to throw roadblocks in front of himself by trying to play something that he couldn't play. So this was one of his first experiments on mandolin. We still have the original cassette that he gave me of Losing My Religion, and it is exactly the same arrangement. Wow. It sounds identical to what wound up as the final version of the song. So that's all Peter. You know, Everybody Hurts was Bill Berry, and Supernatural Super Serious was Mike Mills. I mean, those guys quite often would turn in things that were so brilliant. And you know, even they, I think in the arrangement, they might not realize that, well, I can flesh this out with a story. I can throw a trajectory and a narrative into this and make this arrangement work. Sometimes no, sometimes we had to make a lot of arrangement changes in order to fit the vocal or the melody into the song. I was always about shorter songs. I always wanted to get in and get out, leave them wanting more always. And so a lot of the stuff that I'm doing as a solo artist is much, it's very pop, but it's incredibly short songs.
Would you start with like a scat vocal, or would you start by writing? Just tell me the process of you hear music, you're inspired by it. How do you get to a song? What's your process?
Historically, I hear music and I'm inspired by it, and there's a melody that comes along, and I close my eyes and I see a landscape, and music translates to me as a visual. And so a good music, bad music is just fucking horrible, like bad, like what my dentist was playing this morning, by the way. I hope he's listening. I was like, we have to talk about the music. We have a very good rapport now because his dental assistant and he have very different musical tastes. So they'll throw a song on when I'm there just to see how I react And one of them will say, Michael, and I'll say, like, turn it off now. Like, next, next, next. And she'll crack up because she'll have told him he's going to hate this song. This is not a good song.
Do you write just the number of lyrics that are in the song, or are there sometimes more verses? Like, how does it happen?
There's often more verses, but it really depends on how much I, going back to the conversation earlier about trusting your gut. Mm-hmm. You know, when I close my eyes and I see that music, I always saw my job is now to put a narrative on top of that, to create some kind of story that people can follow along with. And it doesn't have to make really linear sense. I'm really good at not making linear sense. Sometimes it makes a lot of sense. And sometimes you need a little bit of an indication of what's happening, but clues as to what the story is actually about. And I hope to provide those as a lyricist. I hope that by the end of the song, I will have provided some clue to what's going on. I did that with REM, and I'm doing it now as a solo artist. So hopefully it's going to work. There's another song that we're working on right now. The working title is I'm the Charge. And everything you need to know about this character is in the second verse and the last three words, which have nothing to do with the rest of the song. But they set up another song, which is an entirely different piece of music. Mm-hmm. And it's the same character 30 years later. And I'm following the arc of this character over time. And I'm imbuing this character with this extremely shifting sense of self, going from someone who's extremely vulnerable and quite difficult, but always in charge, always in power, to someone who's extremely invulnerable and almost cynical in their work. But they've developed this very tough skin, but they're now using the vulnerability of their youth to be able to create work that, although is uninteresting for them, inspires others. Boy, that sounded like a really bad off-Broadway play, didn't it? I'm sorry. I'm talking to myself here and you just happen to be present. Sorry, Rick. Anyway, the song is called I'm the Charge. And the second song is called, the working title would be Pole of Love.
Will the whole album have an arc like that?
I don't know yet because I'm still working on it. No, I don't tend to write. I will revisit characters from time to time. And then I have to question, often I have to question myself, like, how did I embody this person? What gender did I make them? What political leaning did I give to them? What horrible position did I put them in that they now have to work their way out of or have some cathartic moment that pulls them out of it? Like the song Sad Professor or one of my favorite REM songs, Country Feedback. That song, I think, and in my memory, I sang it one time, and that was it. I think in the re-release that the band put out, the 25th anniversary re-release, they found a demo. But you hear at the very beginning of the song, I say, these clothes, and I pause because I came in too early. And then I say, these clothes don't fit us right, and I'm to blame. It's all the same. I didn't know the song. I hadn't worked it out. I hadn't mapped it out. Peter has this memory of me walking into the studio with a piece of paper that had a drawing of an Indian, a pencil drawing of an Indian on it and a few words on a piece of paper. And he said he walked in with that and that was the song. And that became Country Feedback. The working title was Country Feedback because it sounds like a country song. It was very obviously inspired by Neil Young and it has feedback on it, feedback guitar on it. So the working title became the title of the song. I remember performing it. And it was at John Keane's studio in Athens, Georgia, and it was in an ISO booth, and I was in headphones, which I can't stand to sing into because the engineers can never get the mix right for me, and mm-hmm. It makes me crazy. I hear myself too much or I don't hear enough, and I like singing into an open mic at a desk, but that, of course, causes all kinds of problems with digital technology. Anyway, I remember singing it, walking out, and walking out of the house and the studio, and I was done. That was it for the night. I didn't remember it until, I don't think they even played it for me the next day. The band listened to it, and I think they listened to it a few times. And then I came in 2 days later and listened, and I was like, this is it. I'm not going to re-sing it. That's it. That's the take.
So great.
I did the same thing with World Leader Pretend, Rick, another song that the heavy of obvious inspiration there was Leonard Cohen. I lifted everything that I could from that beautiful writer of a man, beautiful man of a writer. And I used, the language, uh, the the dialect of war to describe an inner battle, a deep emotional turmoil inside the protagonist of that song. And I sang it once. And I was so impressed by myself that it was the first time that REM put, that I allowed the lyrics to be printed on the album sleeve. We were, I think, 9 years into our career at that point. And I had yet to lip sync in a video. I refused to do it. I thought it was too cheesy. So we were, you know, as a band, we always knew what we didn't want to do. We knew that we didn't want to be cheesy. If we were going to be cheesy, we were going to be cheesy on our own terms. And God knows we were. But they were on our terms.
Yes.
And they were quite beautiful when it happened. You know,
yes.
there was an element of cheese there and sentimentality, and that's okay. That's part of pop music. But it was on our terms always. And I'm so very proud of that. You know, what we left behind is this body of work that I include the times that we fell on our face publicly, and I did many, many times, and I humiliated and embarrassed myself over and over again in public. But guess what? I embraced those moments along with the hit singles and the triumphs and the moments of absolute joy. And being able to meet people like yourself and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan and Patti Smith and Tom Verlaine, my hero, you know, I don't even like guitar. And here's Tom Verlaine, you know, the one guy that I could actually watch play guitar and not blink for 40 minutes, other than Peter Buck, of course. Yeah, what a life that provided me, and what a journey I've been on. I feel like really a very, very lucky person. I had this ridiculous teenage fantasy dream idea of what I was going to do with my life. And I actually, with a lot of work, I actually made it happen. And here I am kind of looking back on it, but I'm also looking forward, because, you know, the songs that we've put out, that I've put out, each song for the first year of its release, all of the money that I would make on that song, whether it's through a movie, through a TV show, being in a commercial, which hasn't happened yet, but I'm offering it up right now on this podcast, all of the publishing that I would make from the first year of the release of that song goes to a charitable organization of my choosing. So far, it's been Extinction Rebellion and Pathway to Paris. Extinction Rebellion for the first song that I released as a solo artist, which is called Your Capricious Soul. And then Pathway to Paris is an organization trying to hold the United States and other nations to the Paris Agreement in terms of environmental, a blueprint for where we need to go in order to not wipe ourselves out and take a lot of other species with us. And that was a song called Drive to the Ocean, which I'm extremely proud of. And I think I'm just going to release them a single at a time. I don't feel like I need to compete with Dua Lipa or name whoever's amazing right now. Who's amazing? Rosalia. What the fuck? Where the fuck did that come from? She's incredible.
We'll be right back after a break with more from Michael Stipe and Rick Rubin. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com. where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with Michael Stipe, but before we jump back into this conversation with Rick, let's hear his new song, Future If Future.
How that got written. Tell me the story of writing it.
It's one of those songs that just flew out and I didn't think too much about the lyric. The music, I believe most of the music came from Andy LeMaster, but we worked together in the studio. I don't play an instrument. I played classical piano when I was a child. I played accordion as a very young man. I think I was 8 or 9 years old when I picked up accordion. And then I stopped both and forgot everything that I knew about music and reading music because I read classical piano off the page, but I don't play anything. So I became the singer in REM, and that's good and fine. And from time to time, I would have a guitar and pretend like I could play it, but I couldn't. I still can't play an F or a B. But I started writing after REM disbanded 10 years ago. I started writing music on synthesizer, and really enjoyed the process. And realize how really difficult composing is. I mean, it's a way different story from lyrics and melodies and singing. You know, it's just a way different thing. And also working on music, I would almost go into a trance state, which is good because I would forget who made the music. And it was, in fact, me or me and Andy working together. This one is mostly Andy, I think, musically. And then the lyric flew out of me. I didn't really question it or overthink it. And I think that that's really my superpower now. My superpower as the singer of R.E.M. was realizing that as a man, presenting as a man in my era, in my time period, that my vulnerability and my ability to express that vulnerability was really something that we had not seen in a way that wasn't just super hyper cheesy and manipulative. So that vulnerability became my superpower. Now, I think my superpower is recognizing that, and my gut is really, really good. And if I don't overthink things, you know, write drunk, edit sober, you take that and extrapolate it and you move it into a not like Norman Mailer or Gore Vidal like universe. I write without thinking. I go into a trance and I write. And then I edit, and I edit sober, and I go, okay, that's crap. That's bad poetry. That's not bad, not great poetry, but if we repeat it a few times, maybe it's a good chorus. And you use those tricks that you learn. But I don't overthink things anymore. I just kind of let them flow out. And when they're not flowing, I put them aside and I go work in photography or other mediums. And I'm working in all these different things now. I'm putting out photo books, and I have a big show in Milan. I'm having a solo exhibition at the ICA in Milan of all the work, that the plastic work that I do, the stuff that's sculptural or photo-based. And there will be a musical component to that show. But yeah, if the music is feeling a little stale, then I just jump to one of my other things, and I come back around and I listen to it with fresh ears and I go, wow, that's one of the worst choruses I've ever written. So let's reexamine it.
I want to come to the show in Milan when that happens.
Oh, beautiful. It's opening in early November 23.
You said something interesting, that your superpower in REM was your vulnerability. When did you realize that? Because I imagine in the early days, you were just vulnerable. You weren't somebody who understood that your vulnerability was a superpower.
No, I didn't understand that at all. I didn't understand from the very early moment that we spoke about, where I decided at the age of 15 that I was going to become a singer in a band. It didn't occur to me that you have to have a modicum of talent. You have to be able to do something. You have to be able to stand on stage and perform. You have to be able to write songs. You have to be able to sing those songs. You have to work with other people. You have to travel nonstop. You have to eat really shitty food most of that time. You have adrenaline and addiction issues to deal with, because adrenaline is the most hardcore drug I've ever in my life taken, and I've taken everything. But you know, I quit drugs when I was 23. I drink occasionally now. I still love to drink, but I know it's not good for me, so I try to limit it. I'm thinking about going back to gummies. You know, I'm excited here in New York. You know, it's now legal, and I haven't touched weed since I was 17 years old. So, although actually the truth is, I worked on a record with Fisher Spooner, kind of accidentally reintroduced me to music about 5 years ago. And I wound up producing their album. And it's a really good record called Sir. And it's a very, 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 very queer, very gay record in terms of its thematic content and its trajectory. But in writing that record, I experimented with weed a little bit. And I smoked weed for the first time since, I was a kid. And some pretty good songs came out of it, I have to say. So who knows? I'm excited. I'm really, really sensitive. I'm allergic to all these foods, and I'm allergic to all this stuff. And I have to be very careful, you know, like what kind of things I breathe and all this blah, blah, blah. But so I can take the tiniest amount of weed that would, you know, that would other people wouldn't even feel, and it knocks me over. And but it makes for really good lyric writing. So maybe I'm going to move into weed now. That'll be a third act for me.
What's your favorite song on the Fisher Spooner record?
Well, the one that I wrote weed to is called I Need Love. And I'm thinking about covering it. I think it's such a good song.
What motivated you to feel like it's time to do a solo project? It's interesting that you haven't done one yet. And the fact that now you're deciding to do one makes it interesting with this window of time.
I can be really honest, and I've said this before, but I love my voice. I love my singing voice. I don't like my speaking voice, although I'm really glad we're talking, but I love my voice, and I feel like I have a limited amount of time in which to use that voice. You know, I kind of feel like, I mean, I'm not a Christian. I'm a deeply spiritual person, but I don't really follow any particular path. But I do feel in a way that, I don't know, I've got a beautiful voice, and I really enjoy it. And a lot of people like hearing me sing, and music is a really powerful medium. And I feel like I've got a lot to say. So why not use that voice and stop talking? Just get back to singing. And I enjoy it a lot. You know, it's my first real love was photography. And I've now been putting out a book a year. And I intend to do that for the rest of my life. And I hope that I live a really long time. I hope we have 40 or 50 more books coming. As much as I find immense joy in putting together images that I've taken or things that I've collected and showing them to kind of introduce the way that I see and feel and interpret the world and the way that I move through it. Because I do feel like, you know, we're all unique in our own ways, right? We're all little snowflakes, but there is something to the way I put things together that I think is enjoyable for other people. So I really like doing that, but nothing beats coming up with a lyric and a melody that people come back to you 2 days, 3 days, 4 days later and say, I can't stop singing your song. Thank you for that. That song was there for me at a very important moment for me. You know, that kind of stuff. I sang last night, in fact. Rick, you knew Hal Wilner, I'm sure. And we had a memorial for him the last night at St. Anne's Warehouse. And I did a song written by his best friend, Lou Reed, that I had covered for the Velvet Underground record that came out with Todd Haynes' documentary. Mm-hmm. And I told Hal, I said I would participate in the project if I could have the first song on. It's a recreation of the first album by the Velvet Underground, which in my life ranks as one of the top five records of all time.
Yes.
You have to interpret music like that in the same way that you interpreted Hurt and handed that to Johnny Cash and said, do what you do with this. And he took that and he made it a better song than it ever was or ever will be again. And we have you to thank for that. And Mark Romanek did the video for that, correct?
Yes.
Beautiful, astonishing video with June. It's really one of those like moments. And, you know, I know you're not a boastful person, but you should be very, very proud of that moment that you offered all of us just in that one single collaboration. That's such a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Do you like singing in front of people? Do you like the feeling of being in front of an audience?
I blacked out last night on stage because there were no vocals in the monitor. And I just went into kind of, I had rehearsed it 3 times. So I don't really remember the performance, but everything before it and after it was okay. As soon as I found out that the voice was actually in the house, then I was okay. I couldn't tell if my voice was actually being projected into the house or not. But yeah, when you do something that's not just one song at a memorial or on a TV show, you know, you go into an adrenalized state. And as I mentioned earlier, that's the most powerful drug I've ever taken. And it's why I think so many of our people, and I'm speaking of creative people, wind up in trouble because you come off of a tour, or you wind up, you finish a movie, or, you know, if you're in the Harlem Globetrotters, or if you're a professional athlete, you stop the tour and your adrenaline is running at a rate that's superhuman. And you can't really match that with anything. The only thing that I found, and I started this in the late 80s to combat that hyper adrenalized state was acupuncture. A lot of body work, but mainly acupuncture really helps a lot to kind of retune the endocrine system, and particularly the kidneys, the kidney energy, as the Chinese would call it.
Beautiful. So it's almost like it's just that the nervous system is on high alert and you just need to calm it down. And it seems like acupuncture does that.
Fight or flight. And then, you know, after you make an album, and you know this from working as a producer and otherwise, you know that you have this kind of postpartum, you know, you intensely work on something. So you put everything that you are into it, and then it's over. And whether it's a tour or a record or what have you, you go through this kind of postpartum, and the adrenaline has to go back down to not a fight or flight kind of place. And for most people, that's very, very difficult. And to try to mimic the high that you get from adrenaline is literally impossible.
Well, I want to thank you just for the songs. There are so many songs that you've written that have meant so much and that are so beautiful. And I just want to thank you because I love them. I love the songs.
Thank you, Rick. And I love you. And I love how, I love receiving compliments from you. But, yeah, thank you. I'm really... you know, I can pretend to have humility, but I'm really proud of a lot of the work that I've done in my short time on this earth. And thank you. I really appreciate that. Obviously, I'm a giant fan of your work, and it's a great pleasure. After all these years, we haven't seen each other in some time, huh?
Been a while.
But it's really great to talk to you and be able to just unravel some of these threads, huh?
Same. And we will change that and see each other soon. I know at one place or another, maybe in Milan, you never know.
Please come to Milan.
Okay, great.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks to Michael Stipe for giving insight into his early days with REM and sharing details about his upcoming solo project. To hear our favorite REM and Stipe solo songs, check out the playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you like this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. For theme music by Kenny Beats, I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
I'm Ben Natifafri, host of the history show The Last Archive, and I want to tell you about a new series we're running in our feed. It's called The Deadline. 6 essays written and read by Jill Lepore, the New Yorker writer, American historian, and founding host of our show. These are incredible essays on everything from the history of cryogenics to the Silicon Valley gospel of disruption. And at the end of each essay, I interview Jill about her craft as a writer. You can listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.